And welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I am Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Beth Malone.
Hi, guys.
Beth, we are so happy that you have joined us today to talk about a very, very intense case.
I am thrilled so to be here, and I'm so excited to discuss this particular case since it happened literally in my backyard here in Colorado.
Ooh, amazing. Ooh. Beth, you have an amazing, storied, successful career, and the thing about our show is we don't want to talk about that whatsoever.
Awesome.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay, great. Sounds like you're like us. All Jess and I like to talk about is true crime. We're obsessed with it. We know a lot of colleagues like you are, too, and you know, it makes us wonder, are we serial killers? Am I a serial killer? Do I sleepwalk? Do I murder people while I'm sleepwalking? So, Beth, when did you first realize you had an interest in true crime? Why are you into it?
Well, there was a time where the only channel I could get was showing Forensic Files back to back to back. And so I went down this creepy road, and then I started just obsessing about it and trying to, you know, solve the things before the people solve them and try to, you know, just sort of get into the minds of these people who were doing these heinous things. Most of the time our blanket response to this is just get a divorce. Why do you have to murder?
Exactly.
Why the murder? Like, there's divorce. This is what divorce is for. But Shelley and I, my wife and I, we are obsessed with it. And oftentimes Shelley will turn at me and look at me and she goes, why do we find this entertaining? Why are we watching people murder each other for fun? We can't wait.
I wonder if you're going to agree with me, Beth. I think that as actors, we have this fascination because it's our, you know, for all intents and purposes, our job to put ourselves empathetically into the shoes of someone else and to understand maybe the psychology and the mind of a character. And so sometimes I attach myself, like you said, to the psychological, you know, why would somebody do this? Like, isn't the easier answer divorce or just I don't like you anymore? Let's move on. And sometimes I wonder as the actor, like we get so invested at solving a case or wanting to understand the ins and outs of the brain as far as that stuff is concerned. And even though you look at each other, right, like you and your wife look at each other and go, why the hell do we find this so incredibly intriguing? And I know that it's sexy and entertaining, but at the same time, I think that we as actors, there's like a little switch in our brain that's like, I want to solve this shit.
Yes, that's right. That is absolutely right. It's like, I want to get to the bottom of it psychologically. I want to understand it. So if you've ever done like Greek tragedy and when you're like, oh my God, she's going to murder her children in that cave. And like what in our, you know, experience could prepare us possibly for playing that scene? Hopefully nothing. So, you know, I think there's a big part
amen.
Of it.
The Coco Roro.
Yeah. The Coco Roro.
We're all living a Greek tragedy every day.
We truly are. But now, Beth, you already let us know this. This particular case happened in your backyard. Can you? You were raised in Colorado. You're from Colorado. Yeah, is that?
Yeah, I'm sitting in Colorado as we speak. And last year, I happened to be around. I think it was around. Was it around like fall of last year? It's so recent. I was around when this was happening. My best friend lives in Firestone, and that is where this all happened, Firestone area. And it was happening in real time, happening on the local news, happening in the oil and gas industry, which has been like a hugely contentious thing here in Colorado. So, and that whole community of people coming to our state from other states, there's been this huge influx of out-of-state folks coming here to work because of the oil and gas industry. So there's all kinds of nefarious crap that's attached to the oil and gas industry that really nobody addresses, like prostitution and drugs and murder. So it was an interesting time last year when this was all going down, because all of these massive, what they do when they frack here in Colorado is they build this huge wall around it. So you can't see what's going on behind it. And it's very mysterious. They put these things right next to housing developments, right next to freeways, these big walls, right like this, where like nothing behind that is visible to the population at large. And we all just have to be okay with it. And it's very, very nefarious.
Jeez. That's like an episode of Black Mirror waiting to happen. Yes. Yes.
Yes, it is.
That's exactly right. Well, I think to anyone listening right now, you'll start to understand this further why we're talking about oil and gas. But for those of you who follow true crime cases as closely as the three of us do, this case likely blew your mind as much as it did all of ours. And like we said, it's one of the most recent cases that we are discussing. And the information itself has been vast, super alarming, considering its circumstances. So you're probably going to go on a nice little deep dive after you hear about this case today. Just you wait. So this is the Watts family murders. But first, credit where credit is due. We got some of our information from Wikipedia, CBS News, The Coloradoan, The Sun, The Tab, and the people of the state of Colorado versus Christopher Lee Watts. So here we go. Christopher Lee Watts and Shanann Catherine Watts, by all accounts, looked like the perfect couple. The two met in North Carolina, where they wed, and within 5 years had two beautiful baby girls, Bella Marie Watts and Celeste Catherine Cece Watts. Shanann had been previously married, a relationship that did not end well, according to her, but there are no statements really from her first husband, and most of their relationship has been kept private, but Shanann herself was very open on all of her social media about her personal struggles with her health issues. Shanann was diagnosed with lupus, which understandably put her into a very depressed state upon when she was diagnosed, and she thought that she would never be able to have children. So the births of her two girls were true miracle babies, and they subsequently moved to Colorado and lived in a 5-bedroom home in Frederick, Colorado, which I believe is just north of Denver, and a home they purchased in 2013, and they seemingly were headed towards happily ever after. But sadly, that is not why we are here. Shanann and her two girls went missing, right, on August 13th, 2018, after Shanann returned home from a business trip that she took to Arizona. And something to remember here, again, for those of you who heard Beth talk about this earlier, Chris was employed by Anadarko Petroleum, while Shanann was an independent representative for a marketing company called Thrive. And while on her trip to Arizona, Chris was watching the girls, Bella, who's 4 at the time, and Cece, who is 3 years old at the time.
Now, Shanann was officially reported missing by her best friend, Nicole Atkinson. And I'm just going to stop us right there, ladies. I want to talk about this. Everyone needs to get a BF like Nicole Atkinson, right? She didn't waste any time. And speaking as a Gen Xer, there's this myth that was perpetuated in TV and film that you have to wait 24 to 48 hours before calling the police. That is not true. You can do it right away. And that's exactly what this best friend did. Right? Talk to me, ladies.
That is right. I was like, they found her within 48 hours of her going missing. They found Shanann and the girls within like 48 hours, right? So it wasn't a mystery very long. And the only reason, because the longer this goes, as we know in true crime, the worse your odds get in finding them and solving anything. So the fact that that best friend was like, nope, 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 nope. I know this girl. She is not where she's supposed to be. And it ain't right.
Hi.
Hey, Nicole?
Yes.
Okay. What's going on?
So my friend, we were out of town for a business trip this weekend.
Right.
And I dropped her off at 2 o'clock this morning. She's 15 weeks pregnant. She wasn't feeling well. And she had a doctor's appointment this morning at 9. And I told her to let me know if she needed me to take her. She's got two little girls. And she was very distraught over the weekend, wasn't eating normally or drinking. And we kept trying to force it on her because she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband and her supposedly are separating. But she didn't know this. She thought they were just having issues. He disclosed that to me today.
That was amazing.
Yeah. There's instinct associated with that. It's...
Absolutely. Another really wild thing about this particular thing is that the whole thing was caught on like iPhones, which is why you could make like the whole thing was made into a documentary with just like footage from people's iPhones. And it's just such a weird time we're living in where every single thing that happened was caught. It was captured in real time. Like the friend freaking out in the driveway and knocking on the door. She just was like, I'm going to roll on this. I mean, what's that about?
We're going to get into all of that. We're getting into all of that. And it's, you're so right. I think that's, this almost looked like a Lifetime movie, except it wasn't. It was happening to real people in real time. And I think that's one of the strangest parts about it.
It is.
Yeah. You kind of, you feel like you are, you feel like it's one of those things where you're almost like a voyeur looking from the outside. Like, should I be seeing this information right now? Or should I be looking at this body cam information? And should I be seeing this iPhone footage? But at the same time, I guess sociologically, at least that's where my obsession goes, is I'm watching this best friend, Nicole, say right off the bat, this is totally unlike my best friend. This is something that she would never do. We have to figure this out. You have to call these people. We have to get, I mean, it's, again, if anybody wants to apply for the role of Nicole in my Lifetime movie, I'm perfectly fine with it. Because I want somebody to be on my ass just like she is, because look at the timeline.
Aren't I that person to you? I text you 74 times a day.
That's absolutely true. You do text me that many times a day. I stand corrected. God bless. Moving on.
Thank you. All right, let's get back to Nicole. So Nicole became concerned when Shanann missed a scheduled doctor's appointment and failed to return any text messages, which is very unlike her. You should also know that at the time she went missing, Shanann was 15 weeks pregnant with a son whom they had named Nico Lee Watts. After Shanann missed yet another business meeting, Nicole Atkinson went to the Watts home at about 12:10 p.m. to check up on her. You guessed it, no sign of Shanann. When the doorbell ringing and knocks went unanswered, Atkinson notified Chris, who was at work, and called the Frederick Police Department. An officer arrived to conduct a welfare check at about 1:40 p.m. Chris arrived home, seemingly calm at first and unaffected. He had a conversation with police officers about where Shanann and the girls could possibly have gone and ways to locate the family.
Now, side note here, and Beth, I want to know your true opinion about it. The officers who arrived at the home for this welfare check, they were all wearing body cams. And it's my opinion. I don't know how you feel. I think that changed the game as far as evidence is concerned.
Well, I think it was like the only thing I remember about that particular one was the neighbor finally getting the cop alone going, hey, that guy's acting weird. He never acts like that. That guy we just met, different guy. You know, because he was like, Chris is all agitated and he is acting strange. And this is a very quiet, very subdued. I've never heard five words out of this guy. And all of a sudden he's like spilling his guts and giving his whole life story. And his, like, it was the elaboration of a bad liar situation.
Yeah.
Ego negation or something. You know,
was like that a word?
Try to say it so that they, I think I want to look it up. I could be wrong. Fact check me, fans. But I think it's called ego negation, where you try to get out ahead of it. Like, no, I couldn't. It's definitely not me. You know, and no one was thinking it was you until you said it. You know.
Yeah.
The reason I'm like, I think it changes the game is because you see his reactions that are happening and his demeanor to so many people. Like you said, Chris walks out of the house and his friend is like, this is not like him. There's something wrong with him. So that's number one. Number two, you know, when the public saw the footage and, you know, some people who were there talked to him, some say he was very calm. Some say he was in shock, which is why he acted, you know, he was shifting from foot to foot and he was very physically strange. But I think to be able to see all of that was,
I didn't find his behavior
probably very helpful.
That weird, because I don't know the guy. I thought he was doing a pretty good job of lying.
I did at
that
at the time
moment.
Too.
I thought so too. I was like, oh, and he was like discovering the phone was still there in real time. He was like, oh, her cell phone's still here, like a mystery. You know what I mean? He was pretty good.
Yeah, and I don't know about you guys, but I try to give quality points to. You never know how you're going to react in that situation. Everyone's different. So you don't want to judge someone for not being too emotional, right? Because everyone is
different. Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people behave all kinds of weird ways when they are in shock, you know?
So we're in the house and Chris gives the police officer permission to search the house. And there was no sign of Shanann or the girls. The searchers discovered her purse containing her phone, her keys, and her medication. Nicole, present for the search, noted that Shanann would never have left the home without her medication. Her car, which still contained the girls' car seats, was in the garage. Her wedding ring was found on the master bed. For all intents and purposes, Chris seemed agreeable and allowed the police to take the lead. The FBI and the CBI joined the investigation the next day, August 14th. Chris initially told police he had no idea where Shanann, Bella, or Celeste might be and had not seen his wife since 5:15 a.m. on the 13th when he left for work. He gave several local TV interviews outside the house pleading for their return, saying not having them home was, quote, earth-shattering. But to friends of Chris, something just did not sit right.
Did you see those interviews, Beth, in real time? I mean, was that something that...
I do. I remember seeing the one where he's standing on the porch saying, I just want him to come home. I just want him to come home. Life, you know, life, the house just... But that was the first time in real time I was like, that is not adequate. That is not adequate acting. That what is happening right now. Because what he ended up saying was... something like the house just, it's just not as good without him here or something like that. It was just inept.
I want them wherever they're at. Like I have no inclination of where they're at right now. And it's just like, there's, it's like, it's vanished. Like she's not, like when I got home yesterday, it was like a ghost town. Like she wasn't here. Kids weren't here. So I have no idea like where they went. And it doesn't, it's just earth shattering. I don't feel like this is even real right now. It's like a nightmare that I just can't wake up from. I'm just hoping right now that she's somewhere safe and maybe she's there. But right now it's just like, if she's vanished, like I want her back so bad. I want those kids back so bad. Yeah, I mean, everybody's going to have their own opinion on anything like this. I just want them people to know that I want my family back. Like I want them safe and I want them here. Like this house is not the same. I mean, last night was traumatic. Last night was... I can't really stay in this house again, like, with nobody here. I've never seen something like this in my lifetime, unless it was on TV or a movie. And this doesn't seem real at all. It just seems like I'm living in a nightmare, and I can't get out of it.
Was that an alarm bell for you, where you were like, this shit seems wrong?
I was like, this guy, he should have taken some Meisner before he decided to go on TV and pretend.
That is the problem when you have a bunch of actors watching these shows, though, because we're like, no, that's inauthentic. I don't believe you.
No, lying.
Yeah.
I mean, but honestly, naturally, after he does all of these television interviews, what do police and investigators do? They question those who are closest to the victims, namely, you know, the first person being the husband. So police end up bringing Chris to the interrogation room and start to ask him about his relationship with Shanann. According to Chris, they were very excited to be pregnant with a boy, but it came as a complete and utter shock to Chris as they had not been trying to get pregnant. And as the hours and hours dragged on in the investigation room, investigators began to ask about financial troubles that were hidden behind a seemingly very golden facade. The couple had filed for bankruptcy in 2015. They were pretty heavily in debt. And they were also being sued by their homeowners association and were due in court around the disappearance. And here's another reason why I particularly love investigators, because at the time of questioning, and I don't know if this is something the two of you thought about too, or you know, you could let me know, but police took note of how in shape Chris was, like hitting the gym every day, muscles from Brussels, like just really getting it in all the time. And they asked him why he was so focused on perfecting his appearance, and that it usually has something to do with a possible affair that a spouse could be having, which Chris denied vehemently. He said, absolutely not. I just, you know, health, health, health is wealth. And he told police that his marriage was, you know, just going through the usual ups and downs any marriage might go through. And, you know, and that was really it. But dun, dun, dun. His facade as the distraught husband soon crumbled because the police learned that Watts lied to investigators, naturally, about having an affair with a coworker. Chris Watts was indeed having an affair with Nicole Kessinger, and she called the police to subsequently come in for an interview on her own, which I'm amazed at the amount of deceit somebody can have, because when the girlfriend, Nicole, came in and told police her side of the story, she let police know that Chris was very open with her that he was at the end of a divorce when they had met. He spent so much time at her apartment while Shanann was out of town, either traveling on business or she took a trip with the girls to visit her family down to North Carolina. And, you know, he was a great boyfriend. And she never questioned him as a boyfriend because he stayed in constant contact with her. And when the family went missing, he sent his girlfriend, Nicole, a chilling text message that his family had gone around 3:45 p.m. on the day his wife and kids were reported missing. And she recalls receiving that message. But then after that message, there were like a dozen or more normal messages shared throughout the working day. Probably like, hey, babe, how you doing? Hope you're well. Like, what are you eating for lunch? I mean, that's like, that's crazy to me. And the reason why Nicole came and talked to the police is because she saw the interview on TV and learned that he was still married and that she was 15 weeks pregnant. That's why she came in to talk to police. Isn't that nuts?
Is he an idiot? Is he a neurasthenic imbecile? Like, what is the actual deal with this guy? You think that when you're on the 9 News in Colorado going, oh, I wish they'd come home, you think your girlfriend's not going to see that? And you're like, hey, babe, I'm just thinking about you. Text. You know, it's like, what?
Shanann's parents begged him not to go on television. They begged him to not go on the news because they thought, you know, he's going to be the one that's looked at first. Please don't go on the news. And now, you know, in after the fact, in hindsight, they were like, thank God he went on the news.
Because
this is what came from it. You know, she stepped forward. Thank God.
With all these selfies from their we're just at the sand dunes. The Great Sand Dunes is where she was like snowboarding down the sand dunes. He was like, oh, you're so sexy, babe. You're so sexy. Like these home videos from their vacations as a couple.
I started calling her Sporty Spice when I saw that. I just, because, well, there are two Nicoles in this case. I was like, okay, I've got to separate them. So thank God Sporty Spice came forward. And she, what I was going to say was she really reminds me of Amber Fry in this situation from the Scott Peterson case. Same thing. Like, you're going to be on television. Like, she's going to figure it out, I guess. Well, they're women, so they're dumb. I mean, there's that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. They're dumb. Naturally.
Okay, so let's get back to this. So now that we know all of this information, let's cut to the lie detector test, shall we, guys? So on August 15th, 2018, I'm going to say my single favorite person in this case, investigating agent Tammy Lee, conducted an interview and polygraph test with Chris and Beth. For all of our audience at home, just hands up to the ceiling. Like,
loved her.
Over here.
Loved her.
What a champion. Oh,
my God. Heroic. Skills. Like, she's got skills.
A superwoman, truly. Yeah. Superpower skills in investigating. I'm obsessed with Tammy Lee.
Okay, yeah, as an investigator, as a boss lady. And she is, you know, she's, in our opinion, she is one of the reasons why this case was cracked. First of all, Lee began the interview by saying that at that moment, only one person in the room knew the truth, but that the cool thing was by the end of the test, two of them would. And as you might have suspected, the polygraph wound up bringing investigators inches away from finding out what happened. Also, little known fact here, the polygraph test is said to have lasted for around 7 hours. So here's how it shook out. Chris Watts didn't just fail his polygraph test. He scored shockingly low. The normal score to indicate that someone is lying is around, was it -4? Is that right, Jess?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
And any
I want ideas? Beth to guess. I want Beth to guess what he scored.
So... go ahead, Beth. Do you have any idea what Chris scored?
So the larger the number, the worse it gets?
Yes.
In the negative, yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. -7? -6?
How about a nice
8?
-18? How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Well, that's why our hero was so confident strolling back in there saying, that's now... right. We know you're not telling the truth.
Can we sidebar about this too? How about when he fails? She's alone with him in this room, knowing that these people were strangled. Can you imagine the balls it would take to be in there with this person that you're pretty sure murdered or, you know, you're guessing had something to do with this murder?
I thought the same thing. I was like, you are brave, lady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now,
and she creepy. Was, I'm sure the three of us were just cheering her on when she said such fabulous things to him, like, obviously, if you had anything to do with their disappearance, it would be really stupid of you to be here. I mean, so casual. What a queen.
What a queen.
And obviously, I mean, I hope that, you know, if you did have something to do with their disappearance, it would be really stupid for you to come in and take a polygraph today. Right? Like, it would be really dumb. Like, you should not be here right now sitting in this chair if you had anything to do with Shanann and the little girl's disappearance. Okay?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it so much.
You know, it's everything I've ever wanted to do in an audition room when you walk in and you just want to say to the people behind the table, guys, if you don't like me, just let me know. You know what? If it's not going to work, you just let me know and I will leave you alone. My Tammy Lee moment.
You could walk in and say, I mean, obviously, if you already had an offer out, you wouldn't let me be learning all these pages. I mean, no one would do that, right? That to a person. You wouldn't put me through like learning 12 pages if you already had an offer out.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me. Best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep, that's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors, trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevvies too. Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
So during the control questions where Watts is told to lie, he's told to lie during the control questions so that the machine can pick up his reaction to lying, Lee thanks Watts for being awesome and being a terrible liar. Now, there's a lot of debate associated with polygraph testing. We know this. Usually, the test does not hold up in court to make a conviction, but the test will likely break someone towards telling the truth. And this is exactly what happened in the case of Chris Watts. As soon as he was told he failed, he had the moment of, no, I didn't do it. But then it sunk in, and he asked to speak to his father privately. Look, I'm pretty sure we all hate him, but guys, why didn't he ask for a lawyer? What a dum-dum. I'm glad he didn't, but I kept thinking, aren't you going to lawyer up in the next 5 seconds? Did you think that, you guys?
Yeah, I thought that when he came in to be questioned. I mean, he must have a very large ego and hubris to have gone in probably to the situation and to know that the polygraph test was 7 hours long. By the way, Tammy Lee, God bless. But when he walked in there, his ego must have been like in it to win it, because I would have been like, I think I need to speak to a lawyer. I can't really have this conversation with you without an attorney present. That's
of course.
So yeah, I'm really
he's
surprised.
Not like he's proven himself time and time again to not be a mental giant though, like in this situation. So when he asked for his dad, I was not that surprised. It really didn't. I was just used to him being, you know, sort of not super bright by that point. I was not that surprised when he asked for his dad, but I was like, he's going to tell his dad. That's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it never really occurred to him that it never occurred to Chris. And as far as when we were watching that, that the lie detector test could mean nothing. Like it never really occurred to him that it wasn't a huge nail in his coffin. It was just a thing that happened. To him, it was like, oh, I am so screwed. I'm dead. I thought I was going to nail this.
He doesn't watch crime shows like we do, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so Chris should have been an actor.
That's a lesson for all. Oh. If you're going to do something and then you fail the polygraph, ain't no thing.
Yeah. Ain't no thing, girl. God, ain't no thing.
Ain't no thing.
And next time I'm a dum-dum, I'm gonna use Beth Malone's quote of, I'm not being a mental giant. I like that. Thank you. It's going in my toolbox. So during the conversation with his father, Watts admitted to killing Shanann, but his reasoning, brace yourselves, was that he says that Shanann had returned home from her business trip and he confronted her about separation and divorce. Shanann was onto Chris and his affair. You know, she'd seen credit card receipts for a dinner, for example, like that, by the way, that time that he was supposed to be at home with his two small children, you guys, like, were they being babysat? Did he leave a 3 and 4 year old home alone so he could go out to dinner with Sporty Spice? Like, what? I don't.
God, let's hope not.
He had a sitter. Remember? I think it was like one of their friends. He did? Yeah, it was like one of their friends came over and watched while he went on a date. Well, he said he was going to the Rockets game.
I did not know that.
Right, he did. He said he was going to the Rockets game. And Shanann, you know, listen, we always talk about this, but I always think that women are like the CIA. We are always going to figure shit out. We are always going to like figure out what, you know, what's been going on. Now, she, with their shared finances, happened to look at the receipt and already she had questions circling in her brain of something going on with him. They were not communicating very well. He had not been warm, fuzzy, etc. He was very into the workouts. And also when she said, "What did you get to eat?" she noticed that the bill had been so much larger. And that was a light bulb above her head. So I think she came home from her business trip with something to confront him about, but I don't know if she expected to have him first say, "Okay, I want a divorce."
Well, and that's the thing, right? This is the part that I'm like, brace yourselves, you guys, because he said that her reaction to his request for a divorce was so angry that she killed the two daughters and his only option was to kill her.
That was planted in his head because that was such a sort of a smart idea to try to pitch. You have to look back and realize that who was the polygraph woman?
Tammy
put that idea in his head. She suggested it earlier. She was trying to get him to confess. So she said, you know, maybe she hurt the girls. Maybe that's why you did it. You know, and so he was like, yeah, that's what happened. She hurt the girls. That's why I did it.
That's such a good point, Beth. I totally didn't even think of that.
He didn't think of that
in this way.
On his own.
Yeah, but I didn't even. And that's that again, why Tammy is our superhero, because she knew that doing that would aid in process of getting him to the actual real confession.
Yeah.
By planting something that he could have attached himself to. That's so interesting.
It was brilliant. And it was like a little Gryffindor crack.
10 points for Beth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Beth, also we feel the need to tell you that while you're on this podcast, we consider all of us doctors of crime. So Dr. Malone came up with that fantastic idea right there. So now just so we're all on the same page.
Fantastic.
Now, because Tammy knew that she planted this idea, she also knew that it wasn't the truth. And they decided to, you know, further probe Chris, and he finally crumbled. He let the investigators know that he did indeed, and his father was in the room for this. And I think it's probably moral support that he aided his son in telling the truth. But he did indeed kill his two girls, Bella and Cece. The story is he strangled Shanann and then smothered his two girls. Now, if you out there have had the chance to watch the Netflix documentary American Murder, like the three of us have, you will have had the chance to see how beautiful and innocent and kind these two girls were. We said Shanann, you know, did a lot of social media videos. Her daughters were always a part of that. There's so much footage of these two gorgeous little babies being, you know, thrilled to see their father. They loved him so much. And it was just really pure evil what Chris Watts had done. And even going a step further, he said that he strangled Shanann in their bed on August 13th, 2018. And after he strangled Shanann, Chris said that their daughter Bella came into the bedroom with her little blanket and asked, "What's wrong with mom?" And Chris told her that mom just wasn't feeling well. Now, he said his plan was not to kill his 3 and 4 year old daughters. And to our point earlier, where we said, hey, remember we told you where Chris worked? This is where it comes into play, because he drove out to this oil work site of his previous employer, which is roughly about 40 miles from their home. And I'm guessing, Beth, you've seen, because you're in Colorado, you've seen several of these sites. Like, you know what they look like. Is this something that is a normal thing in Colorado?
They're all over the place. They can be right next to businesses and homes, or they can be out in the middle of a of the plains, which I think is where this one was. If it was 40, 50 miles out, I think it was like northeast of Frederick, this particular one. It was five in the morning, and he put these sleepy little alive baby girls in the back seat with the mom wrapped in a blanket. And they were like,
"That's right.
What's mom? What's going on with mom? She's just tired." So his mom's sleeping on the floor of the backseat of the truck, and the two little girls are sort of falling asleep on each other because it's still dark out, and he's driving them out to, that is the most chilling episode of this entire situation. That scenario where he's driving the dead mom out with the two alive girls.
I know. It's mind-numbingly disgusting.
It's so sinister.
It's awful. Jen, you had your doctor?
Yes. Thank you, doctor. We're really at the crux of it right now. And I just wanted to give an extra trigger warning to everyone, because this is what Jess is about to tell us and what Beth just told. It's truly horrifying. It's really one of the worst things I've ever heard.
That they're
supposed to trust so much. So anyway.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You think to yourself, these two just innocent babies who have never seen anything like this before trust their dad to get in the car, to lay in the back seat. Like Beth said, it's still dark in the morning. You're totally, this is where you're most vulnerable, in my opinion, mm-hmm. especially as a little kid. And, I always think about even, my dog, who feels the most vulnerable when he's sleeping. It's like, I think there's the most trust there when I see my dog laying on his back, just mm-hmm. sort of like, God, I love you so much. And that is what I feel like children are, especially to their parents. You know, that's love and trust implicitly. That's unconditional. And to know that happened on a 40-mile drive, which is 40 miles, I would say, a little over an hour perhaps, to think to yourself what you're going to do. So there's this, it becomes so disgusting in your mind. And once they were there, even though Chris says he had no intention of killing the girls, he decided to smother them before he dropped their bodies into two separate oil tanks. And what truly gets me, and it probably gets the both of you too, is how Chris wound up describing the death of his eldest daughter, Bella. And he said, she, quote, had a quiet will to live and was the only one to put up a fight. And he recounts both of those little girls saying no, 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 daddy, several times before he carried out each of their murders. I don't know how a human being... I don't know how you can function that way. So I really don't.
Here's this guy. He kills his wife. Okay. That happens. It's a horrible thing, but most women are hurt by the man who's supposed to love them. You know, if a woman is hurt, it's usually by the man who professes to love them. That's just statistics. It's a sick fact. But so he's going to hell for that, no doubt. But this, when you drive your kids out and then you have all this time for redemption to set in. You have all this chance to not be this monstrous creature. I mean, I don't know what punishment is good enough for this guy. I don't know what, like, I'm a person who's like, capital punishment is, I mean, I'd like to see certain members of our administration, capitally punished. I can't wait for that day. But that's a whole other podcast. But this guy, like the kind of sinister action that he was able to carry out in the solitude of a northern Colorado gas and oil field by himself with just the sky and the moon and his own dark, sinister soul. It's unbelievable. He should go down in history as one of the most evil ever.
I agree. And also, sometimes when people are at least testifying in court, or they actually bring the defendant up on the stand to talk about it, and they, plead insanity, or they can't remember what happened, or they blacked out, or they had a moment. I mean, he can recount every little thing that happened, to the point where he's actually said, now that he's incarcerated, he has said out loud, you know, I knew that it was going to happen the day before. I mean, he knew that this was going to happen. And there's also, like, there's something wrong with you, bro, where in more than one way, by the way, that you knew that this was going to happen, and you knew about it for at least 24 hours beforehand. And I bet you that your brain even knew about it months and months beforehand.
I don't know if it was the money. I don't know. Maybe he didn't want to pay child support and alimony for the rest of his life. But so what? I mean, God damn.
I mean, Jesus. If you think to your, if you're like, I feel so effing stuck. I mean, look, we've all been through some shit. So there are healthy ways. I don't know. Therapy comes to mind, to get out of a situation that you're unhappy with. Now, I know, you know, according to her friends and family, Shanann was super type A. She had all of her ducks in a row. She had that honey-do list going. You know, she knew exactly what she wanted, when she wanted it. And he was apparently, you know, like the little sheep in the background, according to everybody else. But that doesn't, that's no excuse for one day deciding to crack all of a sudden and be, and this type of sinister act comes out. Like, I think that you've got that darkness in you to begin with. And subsequently, he pleads guilty to all of the crimes.
That, and he was that bullshit. I'm sorry, but that bullshit where they were trying to say, oh, she was emasculating him. That was why he snapped. I was like, oh, no.
Do not victim blame. No.
Exactly. Do not gender role this shit either, because if she's wearing the pants in the family, that's just the way certain, you know, relationships.
Dynamic.
Yeah, that's the dynamic. Thank you. That's the dynamic within that relationship. It doesn't mean he, you know, is justified in any way to any like violence onto his partner. I just like,
oh, that's such a good point. That's such a good point, because you're right. They did use the word emasculated.
I was like,
first of all, that ain't nobody's business. And secondly, you know, relationships, again, they operate on different dynamics. No one relationship is going to be like any other relationship. And the issues that you have with said human being, in my opinion, can usually be tackled, even if they're uncomfortable to discuss. So again, the shaming of that circumstance blew my mind too. I was again like, girl. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And Jessica, did you say you thought maybe was he predisposed to this?
My question to the usually the men, and I know that there are a handful of women who are also guilty of incredibly terrible murders and serial killings, but usually we've seen men in these positions, and that's where my brain goes, is sometimes what happened to you? What trauma did you endure when you were a kid or when you were growing up? Or did something happen where women played a different role for you when you became an adult? Or his brain, if you cut it open, probably wouldn't look the same as ours.
That's what I want to talk about. I would be so curious to see scans of his brain. They can do PET scans and that the frontal lobe of psychopaths do look different than quote unquote normal people. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know if he was predisposed with, they call it the MAOA gene. And usually men have this gene, not all men. And that gene alone doesn't make you a killer. But, you know, I'm just curious. And I'm not saying he has this. I'm just curious. That's what I want to know. Like,
that's interesting. I've never heard of that. That MAO, I never heard of that. You know, like when you have the gene that makes, that you have like a gene that says you probably will get breast cancer, that gene. Well, this is the gene that says you're going to be a dick.
You're more predisposed to violence and aggression, because apparently when you're in utero, you're bathing in serotonin. And serotonin calms us down. And so because you're bathing in it, you become sort of immune to serotonin later. I'll send you a link. There's this great TED Talk from this neuroscientist called Ted Fallon, and I was riveted. Anyway, but I digress.
Well, you know, I just, before I finish off with exactly, you know, his sentencing, you know, he's been pretty matter of fact about all this. I remember in our BFF, Tammy Lee, her polygraph test with him, or subsequently after that 7-hour polygraph test that he did not win. She said to him, you know, you're not crying, man. Where's the emotion out of all of this? And his first response, I believe, was like, well, don't let that, you know, make you think that I did anything. You know, I'm not really a crier, or, you know, something to that effect. And so I do think a lot of it could have a lot to do with his brain and how it functions. But, to, you know, that being said, he was handed 5 life sentences without any possibility of parole. And he received an additional 48 years for the unlawful termination of Shanann's pregnancy. And a side note, and also a very disgusting fact here, is that when he placed Shanann into an oil tank, which was separate from the other 2 oil tanks of his girls, it was so harsh on her body because she went headfirst that she was forced to deliver the baby preterm. And that, you know, is again, so awful. I know your face is
no. I thought she was buried.
I thought she was buried in the ground.
Well, he tried. She was buried in the ground, but he tried to push her into an oil tank.
I did not know that.
Yes, he tried to push her into an oil tank, which forced her to deliver. And subsequently, after the 48 years for the unlawful termination of the pregnancy, he got another 36 years for 3 charges of tampering with a deceased body. So it was her body and the baby. And that's, again, like, it's another reason why this case is so, I don't know, we're all shaking our heads here in disbelief.
I just want to say,
Beth, Dr. Malone.
Dr. Malone has an observation, and that is that when he was in the interrogation room and he realized his goose was cooked, then he cried. He cried for himself. He was dry-eyed when he was talking about all of his children and his wife and the baby and everything. But as soon as his father came in and he realized he was screwed. Remember, he said something about it. It means I'm screwed. Remember, he didn't.
This is it for me.
Yeah, he said that, and then he wept.
Oh, his poor dad too. His poor dad.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, how do you? It's just out of body. And I wonder, Beth, like, being from Colorado and being there and watching this happen in real time, you know, did you have conversations with friends about it? Like, how has it affected the community in any way since it happened? I know it's so recent, but are there, you know, is there anything that you've taken from something being so local?
When you're here, you're constantly seeing those oil wells. You're constantly seeing those tanks out on the prairie. And you can't really look at them without seeing that whole thing now. That is what you see when you look at those. You think, oh my God, can you imagine having to drain that to find 2 little bodies in it? You know, that thing where they came out to retrieve them after he told where they were and what he had done, and that process of getting those little people out of there. You think of all of that when you see them, because you see them all the time. And it's just, it's a reminder of something really, really bad. It's just a reminder of something that makes you just, your blood run cold in your veins. It's just like a really, really cold feeling that you get.
Yeah.
But it's really, the oil and gas industry here in Colorado, I have to say again, has brought all kinds of nefarious folks to our town, because none of the people we're talking about in this story are from Colorado. They were all transplants recently from like South Carolina, North Carolina, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. North Carolina,
North Carolina. The dad had to travel in to, you know, come to that deposition or whatever. And, you know, you have a whole community of people that are transplants who don't have deep roots, don't have deep old friendships, you know, throughout the community, people they can call. The fact that Shanann had made such a true blue, deep, true friend just speaks to what a good person she probably was, and how she, you know, put her heart out there. The thing about her getting all that grief for posting everything on Facebook, a lot of that was because she was living in Colorado and she just wanted to keep her family. You know, sometimes people use that. Yeah. They use Facebook as a journal, like a live journal to let people, especially when you have kids, it's like, look, this is what we're doing today and blah, blah, blah. some of it was really staged, and it made me wildly uncomfortable to watch because I know, you know, the truth of what their marriage is and then what she's trying to put out there. I'm just like, oh, it's just so hard to watch.
But, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it just reminds me, you know, when you, I guess if I could put myself in her shoes, you're right. You're in a new state. You're a transplant. You have two young kids. And I, you know, you probably, it's your second marriage and you want everything to look like it's okay. And sometimes when you say it out loud or you try and convince mm-hmm. other people that everything is okay, there's also a part of you that's convincing yourself that it's okay and that you're going to get through it and you can live with it. And this is, you know, everything that I've wanted. And that's, you know, that's also the sad part about it is knowing behind the scenes that everything was not really okay.
She was trying very hard.
She was really trying. Yeah. She was really, really trying.
And, you know, guys, I hope that even talking about it like this, one of the things I think about is I certainly hope we're not, even by talking about it, re-traumatizing her poor family. And I've read mm-hmm. that people who are on the side of Chris have done exactly that. And I would just beg people to stop it. That poor family, you know, stop.
Well, yeah. I mean, and after, you know, we've done a lot of research on this case, we as the hosts of this podcast want to reiterate the family of Shanann have been so strong as a family. And that can be the hardest thing, I think, for any family. And discussing any crime is super difficult, especially one that is so recent like this, because it becomes the marker and the keystone of any family's life thereafter. Like Beth said, you know, you drive by any of these oil fields in any of these, you know, desolate areas, and that's all you can think about now because of what happened. And so put yourself in the family's shoes in this situation, and it just reminds you of how dark and how evil the circumstance and the case was. And I know we here will forever be thinking about the victims of this particular crime, and we hold them with the utmost dignity and respect. And that's it.
That's absolutely right.
Beth, I'm so glad that you came on to talk about this. If there's anything else that that we might have missed or that you wanted to say, please feel freeth. because we can go on and on about this for hours and hours because the case is so complex, and I don't think it will ever not blow my mind when I think about it.
No, it's like the head shaker. There's an element of him becoming really fit that I think is really interesting and part of like his psychosis in general. That thing where he had to transform his body and you could tell he was gone. I just find that whole, I'm going to be really, really fit guy, mentality to be part of it in some weird way. I don't really know.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. Cause if you remember that moment in the Netflix documentary that we referenced, they go to the beach and there's this footage of them on the beach and Shanann is pregnant again. And I remember watching the footage of him at the beach and he was with his kids, but all he was doing was looking at himself and looking at his muscles and walking toward the water and taking a look at his six pack and his little ab area. And I thought, like, this is the definition of what I think a narcissist is that they're, you know, like, what are the tiers of what I should be caring about right now? And what am I actually caring about right now? And so to have seen that on camera, like you said, like everything was caught on camera. It makes you feel so icky sometimes to see somebody else's life that way. But I know that in that moment, again, like, of course, that beach moment stuck out to me because I was like, can you like maybe make sure your kid doesn't drown versus checking out your guns at the gun show?
Yeah.
and I do think that has something to do with it. I think, you know, we've all fallen victim to like, oh, this new diet, or I'm going to go and do this, you know, new workout, or, you know, and you get so laser focused, but this is psychology next level of how that fits into why this all happened.
Yeah. He was obsessed with himself. Mm-hmm. That's why when I feel like when his life ended, that's when you saw him cry. You know, that is narcissism. That's the definition of a narcissist, I think. So yeah, that, I mean, like, yeah. As far as like that beautiful family, how they looked on the outside and that perfect suburban life, there was something about it that just turned him into a crazed killer, something that all the American dream, the people aspire to, turned him into this toxic waste. I don't know.
Yeah. And what a waste of lives. Those little girls, that's the last thing I want to say, is those little girls running to their grandma in the airport.
Ugh.
I just can't get that image out of my head. These happy, those little, they were beautiful.
They were
beautiful, filled with light and, I'm sorry. I have to stop talking. Like, I'm going to cry just thinking about it. It's really one of the worst things I've ever heard in my life. And I'm so sorry to everyone. I'm just involved. I'm so sorry.
Those little faces.
Yeah. Because when you're, you know, they say, at least in my years of therapy, thanks. Thanks, doctor. We talk about four is the age of fear. So to know that their eldest was 4 years old, and these are instinctually, especially around that age, four, you have instinct of something that doesn't feel right. So the questions of, you know, what's wrong with mommy, or those are things that a 4 year old is inquisitive about. And that's the thing about kids. And you just think of a 3 year old and a 4 year old who are probably used to waking up and having pancakes for breakfast, not being woken up and put in the backseat of a car.
It's just too awful. It's just too awful.
Because you don't know anything different. You don't know anything different. And what dad says goes. And that's the worst part about, you know, using your, you know, the privilege that you get as a parent to get to raise, you know, babies, is that, you know, you are the, you are the pedestal. You are on the pedestal of everything that they could think of as being somebody who they trust. So I do think that that's super upsetting.
The upside is, because I have to find a light in this story, because it is the worst. If you really, really think about it, which we have for the last hour, you start to go down this really dark place, because it's really, really dark. It's really, really bad.
Yeah, you're right.
But the upside is that the law enforcement people and that best friend and the everybody who banded together, the community who rallied around the parents afterwards to show them love and to show up for them. I mean, we have to say, like, there are really wonderful, beautiful things that come out of a horrible situation like that. And one of them is that we know Tammy Lee, like, so she's this person that, like, rises out of this whole horrible story as, like, this beacon of hope and this heroic person doing her job, like, kick ass. And she's literally bringing justice to something that is unforgivable and unfixable, but at least there's justice. And that is, that's the takeaway. We have to have something positive to take away from this.
I think that's a perfect note to end on, Beth, to leave us all with something positive. I do. What do you think, Jess?
Oh, I completely agree. I couldn't be more thankful and grateful that you came on today and talked about this with us and took the time out of your life to have this discussion.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You were a wonderful guest. This was probably one of, if not the most intense case. And I thought you handled it with grace and a sensitivity. And I really appreciate you.
You are.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Beth.
It was fun.
You were so damn cool.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Get yourself out of here, girl.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.
See you, Beth.
Beth Malone, class act.
Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It on Broadway and Twitter at Killing It on B-Way.
Subscribe to us wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.